paper is on the presentation of total equity before the wasting asset goodwill.
Okay. So this is agenda paper 18C, and it discusses some presentation ideas. And these ideas were previously included in the disclosure papers that were discussed in the April and May board meetings. Agenda paper 18C includes no additional analysis compared to the May paper. This section's been included in a separate paper since, as indicated in the discussions in April and May. The merit of this idea is somewhat linked to the decision that we've just made whether to or not reintroduce amortisation. A number of presentation ideas have been considered in paragraphs 3 to 17 of the paper. And the staff think, given the nature of goodwill and the inevitable limitations of the impairment test, the board may wish to highlight an entity's exposure to goodwill and various ways to present a subtotal of total equity before goodwill are then explored in paragraphs 18 to 26. In light of the decisions made so far today, the questions to the board after paragraph 26 ask whether the board want to include a preliminary view in the discussion paper that a subtotal of total equity before goodwill be presented in the statement of financial position. And if not, whether the board wants to include in the discussion paper a brief discussion of the various presentation ideas considered in the paper. So before we ask the questions, I would like to open this discussion up now.
Well, I must say, after the discussion that we just had, I feel doubly motivated for this disclosure. Having heard that at least most of the board members seem to think that to present goodwill as if it's always there is possibly not a good, possibly does not reflect economic reality. And I think that number then should be balanced by another number, which is also not completely correct in most cases, but at least gives the mirror image of, well, what would the balance sheet look like if the goodwill had dissipated and impairment had not caught it. And that also recognizes the imperfections of the impairment only model and gives at least two views to the investor. And I also thought, actually, quite telling what Nick told about the credit analysts of smaller companies who did exactly what I did in my brief period of my life, that I was a credit analyst for small companies, take out goodwill immediately because you knew you would never recover it if the company went bankrupt. So I think it is would be a very valuable disclosure. You would think it's easy to do anyway, especially if we have that separate line item for goodwill. Well, a lot of people don't do the obvious things. And a lot of investors are not sophisticated. And for a lot of investors, when they see a line item like that on the balance sheet, might be an eye-opener. So I think it should be done. Nothing in our world is simple, so you have already found lots of obstacles to do it in the balance sheet as it is. Well, can we perhaps ask the regulatory community who makes those rules that they might find that a good idea? And why don't we just propose it? And then if that doesn't work, find a way around it, separate line item on the balance sheet. What did you call it, Nick?
Memo item on the
memo phase. Item, but a note that is simply no good. A note doesn't do anything. It needs to be right there for the investor who takes a first glance at the balance sheet. He should be able to see it immediately for it to have any purpose. Nick,
so I was just going to support that suggestion. I can't, particularly having it as a memo item. It won't mess up the formatting of anyone's balance sheet, having it as a memo item. I can't see any downside. I can see potential upside, as it's in line with the kind of ratios people are looking at anyway. So, yeah, I'd be supportive of doing that and exploring that.
Martin?
I'm really not in favor of doing that because I think it gives the wrong impression, because it is a kind of, as you said, maybe some people think, okay, that is a kind of in an equity number which is good for credit analysts, which I don't think so, because we have other items which have similar things which are not cash relevant, which is deferred taxes in a different scenario, some other intangibles, and I don't know, I think it is, it will not solve the problem, and therefore I think it, maybe it will confuse other people then what this number would mean, and therefore I'm overall not in favor of doing that. Maybe we separate goodwill, we have said that, and people can do, everybody can do this calculation by its own.
Tom?
Yeah, just going back to the last one, you know, in the end, I voted in favor and believe kind of the staff position that we can talk about testing the CGU and that we can do it reasonably. And in the last paper, in paragraphs 43B and C, you know, it says things like if the impairment test is operated correctly, then the carrying amount, et cetera, is we have a, we, what we think, if we go with impairment, is a legitimate test. As Martin said, we're already identifying goodwill. If we then say, put it in as a deduction and say, use this asset at your peril, which is how I would interpret it, I would say then we should be amortizing. If it is that sketchy an asset, like I voted because staff make a compelling case that we can do a good job on that impairment, but people need to understand it's a CGU. And so I would be, if when we get all this stuff back, if we decide to stick it in goodwill, I'll be voting for impairment. Or if we decide to stick goodwill as a counter equity, I'll be voting for impairment, because I just, it, the signals are so contradictory to me. I wouldn't be happy with it.
Françoise?
I think I support that we investigate that through the discussion paper, and that we do it on the basis of having a footnote in the bottom of the balance sheet, so what you have numbered the alternatives will be. And but doing that, explaining, in fact, the advantages of doing that and also some of the drawbacks, and I think, you know, we I think it's a fine balance between wanting to attract attention and risking to send the wrong signal about the company. And that's it.
Mary?
I think marginally not in favor, but don't have a strong view. I think I'm going to look kind of Neely's way on this. I think we're going to publish, we expect that we would publish the PFS consultation before we publish this.
Right now they're scheduled to come out very close to the same time. Yeah.
Because what I took from this paper is that we have already reached a tentative decision in the primary financial statement project that goodwill will be required to be a separate line item on the face of the balance sheet. So the question is whether we have to, in addition to that, also present it, you know, separately. And I you know, if they're running kind of neck and neck, I think we'll know by the time we publish that is in the balloted PFS project. I think we should consult about it, but I don't think we should do whether our PV is yes or PV is no. I think we should include something about it in here, but I think it should be brief, just that we looked at whether or not there should be some kind of excluding goodwill subtotal. And because this is, I don't want it to distract from getting from people focusing on the bigger ticket things. But I think we should focus only on goodwill as well, because you can have goodwill. You can have goodwill plus indefinite lived intangibles that really are recognized only in connection with the business combination. And then you can have other intangibles that could be acquired in a business combination and hence recognized in a much more much higher cost because their fair value at the date of acquisition than they would be if they were internally generated. And if we were really to do a net tangible asset calculation, we could be, I think, significantly downplaying useful information for, let's say, an entertainment company that has a lot of intellectual property that it's developed internally. And if it were acquired, it just would be, it would be on the balance sheet at fair value as opposed to cost. And I think if we try and do the technically correct. Intangibles, including goodwill, that are recognized only in a business combination, I think it becomes less a communication tool. So I think we say we've already decided to propose that it has to be a single line item. The question is whether, in addition to that, we should require a subtotal to be drawn that excludes goodwill. And just keep it on goodwill. There may be very large numbers that are indefinite-lived intangibles that are recognized only in a business combination, but let's keep it simple.
And that what is proposed, just goodwill, right?
Well, I think we explore in here, you know, how you would deal with these other scenarios.
Yeah. So question one is about including a preliminary review, which would be just goodwill, so total equity before goodwill. But then if that isn't supported, then it's whether to include all options in the discussion process, albeit briefly.
Gary?
Thank you. I support isolating goodwill on the face of the balance sheet. I could be told whether it's alternative to netting against equity or sort of subtotal out on the asset side. I think what's missing in all the staff work in the papers that we've got here is we need something that has a discussion what the essential gestalt of goodwill is. You know, we got stuff on the VIE model and pre-tax models and CGUs, but none of that forces a discussion about what actually is the nature of goodwill. I think isolating on the balance sheet, there's a net against equity, or all by itself away from all the other assets, might force that discussion. Again, without knowing whether, you know, forefront materials in the DP the staff is thinking about, at least the stuff we've been talking about, nothing is dealing with what is goodwill. You know, a philosophical discussion of it. Positioning it in presentation will help, I think, in my judgment, to bring that into whatever feedback we get.
I'd support investigating further, focusing on goodwill. And I don't see it as being contradictory with our earlier vote, because I think really what we're saying is two things. One is sort of be aware there's a very high level of measurement uncertainty around this just by its very nature, and because we can't even measure it directly, so it's even harder than a sort of level three measurement, which it usually is at least direct. And also be aware that in times of trouble this could evaporate quite quickly. So there's something special about this that warrants it getting extra attention, which is why I think it's worth investigating. I think already the proposal in PFS to at least have a separate line item is a good first step, but I think this is worth looking at.
Jiang Wu?
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation. However, are they reinforcing the recommendation?
There is no step recommendation.
Well, huh? There is. It's...
There is.
No.
Nope.
That's the board what it wants.
We don't have a staff recommendation.
It doesn't say the staff recommends.
All right.
This is against all the instincts of the staff, this proposal.
All right. Anyway.
You agree anyway.
With the phrasing of the question.
In substance, you are recommending. Okay.
Between the lines.
Now, similar to Mary's point, but one step further, I'd like to include some intangible assets to goodwill here, some the indefinite lives of goodwills, intangibles, because some non-contractual customer relationship, one of the most good intangibles, to be separated on the balance sheet. However, If we just say some equity before goodwill only, then maybe that kind of thing is maybe manipulated, maybe very with a very good strong intention by the entity to put some amount to that the non-contractual customer relationship as in some separate intentions, and also there are many similar. Intangible that they can be utilized to reduce the amount of goodwill. However, they are basically, maybe not, we can't say they are not just regular intangibles. So I would like to suggest to you to reinforce this preliminary view to include such kind of intangibles. Yeah, that's the one I would like to say to you.
We have heard of several varieties, already complicated as enough as it is. So let's try to answer this question as it is, which is to do we want a preliminary view that a subtotal of total equity before goodwill be presented in the balance sheet, right? Not in the notes, balance sheet, and goodwill only. Yeah? Can I see who supports that recommendation? Okay, we'll see where that goes.
What is the primary view?
That we're going to ask the question. We're going to ask the question in the...
To include a preliminary view.
Yeah.
Okay. Relief. Relief coming.
Okay. So we'll now move on to agenda paper 18D on relief from mandatory annual impairment test. In last month's meeting, the board discussed the possibility of providing entities with relief from mandatory annual quantitative impairment test. In response to feedback received from board members during that meeting, the staff have performed some further analysis. Agenda paper 18D is based on agenda paper 18B in the May 2019 meeting. Some additional analysis on potential cost saving, the robustness of an indicator-only impairment model, the reasons for the staff's recommendation, as well as some of the possible indicators of impairment, as shown on paragraph 2 of this paper. The staff have indicated the additional analysis by putting them in the box. In the meeting earlier today, the staff noted that the board has decided to include in the discussion paper a preliminary review not to reintroduce amortization of goodwill for the reasons summarized in paragraphs 46 to 48 of this paper. The staff would recommend the board to include in its discussion paper a preliminary review to provide relief from mandatory annual quantitative impairment test of goodwill, even though the board's preliminary review is not to reintroduce amortization of goodwill. The staff's question for the board is included in the paper after paragraph 62. The staff would like to ask the board if they would agree with the staff's recommendation to include in the discussion paper a preliminary review to remove the requirement to carry out mandatory quantitative annual impairment test when there is no indicator of impairment, and also for intangible assets with indefinite useful lives, as well as for intangible assets that are not yet available for use, to apply the same relief as for goodwill.
I continue to be unconvinced that we should remove relief this mandatory test. And I think in a context where as part of your analysis, you highlight to some over-optimism of management. In the last discussion, we were highlighting the possible lack of timeliness. I don't think it's by relieving the mandatory test that we are going to best act against those weaknesses. The second point is that, I remember from the outreach that we've done a strong push, in fact, from preparers in particular, so those that are supposed to suffer from the cost, arguing in favor of maintaining the mandatory test, both on the fact that setting up the test, in fact, was largely a one-off cost, and that once you were running it, it was not so costly, and also because for good governance objectives, they do it. And I agree that it is supporting, helping with better governance, and you could tell me, well, it's not our objective to support better governance. except that in that case, I think better governance supports better quality information. And so it goes back to serving our purpose. Having said that, I would take the advantage of this consultation in order to get a feeling of how extensive is the use of the practical expedient. In other words, what is the practice which dominates today? Is it the practice of using the practical expedient? In other words, I think I don't express myself clearly. I would want to understand the extent of the cost saving that not running an impairment test mandatorily yearly would trigger, so that we are better informed after the consultation. Sorry for. I'm happy.
Daryl?
I support where the staff have landed on this. I believe that one of the things that we heard through the process is the fact that there is a significant cost of doing these impairment tests on an ongoing basis. I think we've relied on the indicator approach for other assets, and I would reiterate what I said earlier, is that I don't believe the problem with the test at the moment is necessarily that it's not been done or not been done enough. I think it's either not been done well when it is being done, and doing it less frequently may actually lead to doing it better quality. And we've got the shielding problem in the test, which means even when you do it, you may not get the outcome that we think might be appropriate. So I think we should be providing relief on this.
Mary?
My concern with providing the proposed relief is that we're building a system in which the incentives are to not look for problems, because, as you know, we're creating mechanics that say if you don't see an indicator of impairment, then you don't have to test for impairment, and if you don't have to test for impairment, then you won't have it. Having said that, I am sympathetic to forcing unnecessary mechanical quantitative calculations. Doesn't seem like reinforcing really good accounting, and again, it may force people more on the mechanics than not. My radical suggestion, and it's probably too late in the game to take it up, but my radical suggestion about how to do it would be to say that entities are required to conclude they have evidence to support the recoverability of the carrying value of goodwill. Not say how they do it, but say, rather than nothing has come to my attention that causes me to believe that this is impaired, say, you have to have evidence to continue to carry it unimpaired. And then it changes the incentives, and then I'd be much more comfortable removing the annual impairment test, because it would say you can't just leave it there until something comes up and whomps you on the head and says you can't ignore me anymore. There's a qualitative problem. You have to reach the conclusion that it is recoverable. And I think we've seen in other instances, people said, well, I had some current concerns, but the standard prevented me from recognizing an impairment because I didn't have the trigger, or I didn't have something. So that I'm just worried that we're building an incentive where all, a system where all the incentives point that way. So I'd like to put a generic obligation on a preparer that says, if you're carrying this at X amount, you have to have a basis for believing, maybe it's more likely than not, that amount is recoverable. And then as long as you have a basis, subject to that, yes, I'd be a lot more comfortable with taking away the...
be a cost relief, am I married?
Well, I'm not telling you that you...
Adding an extra step.
Well, I'm not telling you how you do that. I'm just saying you can't carry that on your balance sheet until somebody comes up and says, I'm writing you a ticket. You can't ignore it any longer. And I think good management would say, I'm not going to sit there and just ignore it until the time when there's an indicator that knocks on my door. So, okay, having done my soapbox bit,
yeah. I'm
concerned that just...
Not in favor of
yes.
This. Okay. Martin?
I don't think that we should give relief on that. When we just decided that, okay, this asset is so special that it is separately disclosed on the balance sheet, maybe we have an item which is then equity without goodwill. But now we're discussing giving relief on the impairment testing of that, and we all know that the impairment test was not really effectively. And cost could not be the best argument here. And I'm also not convinced that cost is really a big issue here. And also it was raised, maybe it is, we have also issues with the audit and enforcement in that. And if I think people do the quantitative test maybe only every 5 years, that will also not improve audit and enforcement of that. And I think when at least if you had to do it every year, I think you can at least see some developments, because when you have to create a business plan, discount rates, all this kind of difficult information, and to see some consistency and staff to do that then, or the companies to do that then every year, and then at least auditors have a kind of starting point to challenge them and compare it with the overall development of the industry, of others. I totally against that. And I would maybe more open if we go to amortization, because then it's not relevant, but based on the decision we have made today, I would not recommend to doing that.
This is going to end in us doing nothing at all. Because if we don't have this cost relief, how are we going to get better disclosures in? This is where we're heading. That could be fine. I mean, Gary?
Thank you. Yeah, I support the staff's recommendation, which I've been on that since this first came up some time ago in here. I think, you know, as I look at the project as a whole, we've net-net, in my judgment, if we finish off the set of papers, we're adding work. We're not reducing work. The impairment model, no need to say more on it, but let's just suffice it. In the best of days, it's difficult to do. I think we've added disclosures. We're make some improvements on value and use, perhaps, and post-tax, you know, discount rates. But they don't really change a lot of work once you figure out how to do your post-tax discount rate. I mean, it's still the same formula, same data gathering, and so on. I think it's someplace in here, since one of the PIR's feedbacks across the board was this is costly to do. And up to this point in time, I haven't seen us taking any cost out of it. I think as someone who actually did this model in a former life, I can assure you it takes work out. You know, it's ultimately just, for the most part, staff work, but they have other things to do, and standard setters, accounting, auditing, regular, tend to add more work, not reduce it. So why go through a major mechanical exercise when it's probably pretty obvious there is no problem here? I'm okay on having it suggest, are these the right indicators, and would you suggest different ones or tighter ones or something? I think that's a fair question to ask in here, but I assure you it does reduce work. Is the other thing I'd point out, in paragraph 24, we said in the U.S. survey, 59% used this model in 2016. Again, I would caution that would not necessarily be universally true. You could very well use this model for some elements of goodwill and CGUs and be an impairment model in others. So I suspect it's not quite 59% in actual practice. If you added up all the different goodwill testing incidences that are out there, some very clearly will have impairment testing.
Sue.
I support the staff recommendations pretty much exactly for the reasons that Daryl gave.
Nick?
I also support the staff recommendations. Just a couple of additional things to highlight. Just building on what Gary said, when I met a group of UK preparers last month, all but one of those who was present at the meeting said this would bring cost savings to them unequivocally. So they were convinced. And then also, just to draw attention to paragraph 38 in the paper, and this, I mean, it feels counterintuitive, but evidence from Duff and Phelps saying that in the US, those who used the qualitative test were more likely to recognise impairment loss than those who didn't. It's a piece of evidence, but it's interesting in that respect, I find.
Yeah. First, one small note on Mary's point about in the U.S., my understanding is if you do that more likely than not, you have to do a ton of documentation, and it's not cheap. It goes to this issue about cost savings. So it, I think Mary has a point, and I think if we're just putting out impairment indicators, then it's, there's got to be an onus on the entity to investigate the, like, the indicator. They're not just sitting there hoping one floats by. I think they have to be proactive if we do it. And it's certainly in the U.S. you have to document like crazy, apparently. The second thing is just on, and again, when we looked up the U.S. stuff, because I'd suggested it, the evidence seems to be that there are some cost savings, but not as large as one might think. And there's a little bit of opportunistic behavior, but really very little. So then the question is just, do we provide a cost saving? And a lot of people, as Nick said, still think they'd like to have the option. And just when we go through the question, we're not deciding the issue today. So the big, what we're really deciding is whether to inquire or not. And I think the jury's out, or should be out enough, that we should inquire. And then to me the question is, when we vote, is should we take a clear position as the staff have recommended? And again, I my understanding is this helps. Or should we just neutrally provide the contending alternatives? But I'm a bit worried that if we vote that some people sound almost like they're opposed to it, and so we shouldn't put it in. I'm not sure it's the answer, but I absolutely would like to hear back.
Doc?
Thank you. I disagree with staff's recommendation. And I think the just the impairment only plus just removal of annual test is disastrous because as you all know that when we stop amortization, one of the conditions is to introduce rigorous and operational impairment test. And one of the rigorousness is to do this annual quantitative impairment test. Of course, as staff argued, even if we increase the frequency of impairment test, it does not solve the shielding effect or other issues. It is true, but I need to talk about rigorousness or discipline or prosecutorial issues. So if we just introduce, if we just remove annual impairment test and look at the just the indicators, one of the indicators includes the macroeconomic tendency. So unless you have an indication of macroeconomic tendency, you may not go to the quantitative impairment test. I think it's quite dangerous. So if we have amortization in the background, then it could alleviate and reduce the balance of overstatement. But if you do not amortization and only impairment test model, but you do not do that every year, and look at just the indication, including macroeconomics indication, it is quite dangerous. So I disagree with the staff recommendation.
Dan Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Based on our decision about the impairment-only approach, I also have similar concern as Tuck said, that I think we should still keep the annual, you know, quantitative impairment test in place, because I think this is the safeguard for the effectiveness of impairment of the goodwill. I think the main reason, the concern is about the cost. So I'm thinking about the cost if we introduce the indicator, you know, approach. Once they are indicated, and then the company are required to undertake the impairment test. Actually, existing standards also provide cost relief for those companies. If the assets and liability which make up the unit or the event or the circumstances have not changed since the recent calculation of the recoverable amount, actually those companies do not necessarily to do quantitative impairment test precisely, something like that. So it will reduce a lot of cost when they need to do. If there are some events or circumstances significantly changed, It's very similar to the indicator, those indicators. And then they needed to do precise those, recovery amount calculation, something like that. So I think actually, if we look at the cost, both approach may be in practice very similar. Only those events or those circumstances significantly change the future cash flow or requirement amount trigger, then they will do precisely those impairment tests, quantitative impairment tests. So in this case, I think substantially both approaches similar. So I would like prefer still keep the existing approach, because we change existing approach, it looks like we deliver a signal, we relax sometimes of impairment, a requirement for the companies.
Anne?
I support the staff approach, because what I'm concerned about is us doing nothing. We've done a PIR, we've got a lot of feedback, and we are in agreement about these extra disclosures we're going to ask for. There's a lot of support for those. Well, a lot of support for proposing that we're going to do this. So we need to offset that again, something where the cost savings are. And we've got two more things to talk about, but I would put this in with those to have a package of cost savings that can then be compared against the additional disclosures we need. I'm concerned about slicing and dicing and ending up with nothing as a result of the PIR.
Well, that's what I'm also worried about. But I'm also worried about this proposal in the context of non-amortization. And
I just don't think we lose much because of the headroom.
Huh?
I don't think we lose much because of the headroom.
No, it's such a worthless exercise, we don't lose so much. But is that a message that we can...
I think impairment occurs when it's a big deal, and it will still occur when it's a big deal.
I think the message is just atrocious. Okay, let's have a vote. Who supports this recommendation?
Eight.
Okay.
Regarding 18E, varying use, cash flows, in an earlier board meeting, the board tentatively decided to remove the requirement on an entity to exclude cash flow arising from future cash, future restructuring, and future enhancements from the calculation of value use. And paragraphs 15 to 19 set out the basis for this decision. When the board reached this tentative decision, some board members were concerned that removing this restriction could increase the use of unjustifiably optimistic inputs in estimating value use. Similar concerns were expressed in the latest ASAF meeting as well. This paper includes the staff's analysis of how these concerns could be addressed. The staff recommend that the board should set out a more likely than a threshold for the inclusion of cash flow projections related to future restructurings or future enhancements for the reasons outlined in paragraphs 32 to 40. The staff also recommend that the board should require qualitative disclosures on the future restructuring and future enhancements for the reasons outlined in paragraphs 44 to 50. Questions for the board are included after paragraph 50. Do board members agree with the staff recommendations, firstly, to include a preliminary view in the discussion paper proposing to remove the restriction that excludes cash flow arising from future restructurings and future enhancements from the estimation of value use? Secondly, setting a more likely than a threshold for the inclusion of those cash flows? And thirdly, requiring qualitative disclosures about these cash flows. So I would like to hand over to the board.
Mary?
If we're going to do this, I do not support the more likely than not threshold on the basis that if we're going to do it, let's do it, and let's not put in extra backstops that add complexity. So I'm not supportive of that piece of it. The other thing I would say is, as I thought about the calculations, including future restructurings, I became more and more skeptical about incorporating all the uncertainty into a discount rate. And I think that this may be the time to make the point that I think it's unlikely that you can apply a single discount rate to the cash flows in a situation like this, because if you're going to incorporate return you'd require because of the heightened uncertainty, I'd expect that that would be different in respect to the piece that relates to the restructuring than it maybe does to the others. So going back to the basic theme of how do we get people to really think about IAS 36 and do it better, I think maybe the idea that you can adjust the discount rate or you can adjust the cash flows and not saying anything more, as opposed to making the point that there may be greater measurement uncertainty attached with these cash flows, and so you may have to think about different weighting, especially if it's in a discount rate. I'd rather bring them out and bring that out rather than starting to put in more mechanical requirements to try and backstop it.
Jen Chao.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I appreciate staff's further research, try to set a kind of threshold, because originally the decision we made is that exclude all those cash flows arising from future restructure and future enhancement, whatever the probability of those events will occur or not. So I think I appreciate this kind of threshold. I just one question or one clarification, because originally the existing standard, actually there are some threshold there. If those future the cash flow arising from future restructuring, but those future restructuring, if the entity has not yet committed, that means those cash flow should not be included. So already excluded. So I'm not sure what's the difference between most likely than not and that commitment, because we also require them to disclose those cash flow or those future restructuring to which an entity is not yet committed. So we're still using the wording of the committee. So committing, I think the probability of the commitment is not 100%. So that means, whether 80% or more than, or same as more likely than not, as the previous wording. So I would like to clarify what's the difference between more likely than not and the commitment, that's the probability of the commitment. What's the difference between that? So in this case, I think maybe if it's close, I think actually even when we set in the threshold or the most likely than not, maybe in practice, will not make make a significant difference between our proposal and existing practice. So this, I just would like to clarify, because we're still using the commitment of the wording, and what's the difference between that? Yeah.
I think I can answer that if you want me to try.
Yeah.
I think, but I may be out of date, so others catch me out. I think, Jing Dao, maybe go back to. When you make an acquisition in a business combination, you're considered not okay. Okay, this is an ongoing basis. Never mind. I was thinking back to an IFRS.
Right, this is just a commitment. Maybe okay. 2 years later, something changed.
Yeah,
they
no,
were
no,
not
the
doing
thing I was thinking about
restructuring.
Specific,
so this kind of prep, yeah.
So I mean, in order to under the current standard, in order to include those cash flows, you need to meet the IAS 37. Thresholds about recognising a restructuring provision and whether you've passed that, and there's evidence required
in order to recognise a restructuring provision. And so that is, as you say, there is an element of a threshold there.
Threshold that's most likely not. Yeah.
The staff's view is that is a higher threshold than the more likely than not threshold. So that it's more stringent. There's more obligations to adhere to in order to be able to recognise a restructuring provision.
I agree with the first question A, so we should do that. Secondly, this threshold, I'm not in favour of that, because I think if we do something, we should maybe say this kind of value and use calculations based on discounted cash flow, and cash flow should be based on business plan, which is, I don't know, committed by the management or something like that. And if it includes restructuring, it should include. But more likely than not, I don't know, because if you're doing these calculations, what you're doing, for example, you have to forecast what is my cash flows in 5 years. Man, is it more likely than not? I don't know. It's my business plan, which I think should be based on realistic assumption. And I think we need, if we are concerned about that, we need some kind of this wording. But if it's more 50% or not, I don't know. Sorry, can say that. Secondly, disclosure, I think that is only boilerplate, because what should this disclosure be? Because it is not, I think users are not informed about, or that the purpose is not about future restructuring. It is an impairment test. And why we should then disclose, okay, that in this future cash flows included a restructuring, and why not say it includes 20% of revenue increase or 10% of other cost decrease? I mean, why are we requiring that specific disclosure? Because we are concerned that people are playing with this number, and therefore I think if we are concerned, we should do it in a different way. We should say all this kind of cash flows should be based on realistic budget business assumption or whatever. But to isolate that, I think we should not do and should not have a specific disclosure on that.
I'm supportive of making the change in 1A. I am concerned about the fact that opening this up might sort of move in the opposite direction to trying to improve timeliness of impairment and sort of worsen the situation we have today, where we're told that, you know, people are unduly optimistic, etc. So we seem to be sort of risking moving in the wrong direction. So I'd be keen to put in some sort of guidance threshold of some sort. I'm not necessarily wedded to more likely than not, if that raises people's concerns, but I think at least it should be based on reasonable and supportable information, and make it clear that it can't just be like the best case scenario. It sort of has to be more square brackets, sort of neutral. I don't know, unbiased or something. I don't know what the words are. But something just to make it clear that it needs to be realistic and you need to have a solid basis for it. I'd be happy with something like that.
Tuck.
Thank you. I think it could be a bit dangerous, because if we remove this restriction, then only the number you can count on is the management budget and forecast. And as it is written in the paragraph 26, in most cases, management makes a stretched target. Of course, they have a decent idea, but in order to encourage staff members or encourage the counterparty or whatever intention, management often have a stretched number. So therefore, if that is the number we can count on, then it is quite dangerous. And plus future restructuring. Although we have, you are going to impose more likely than not constraint, I think this is a good idea. I support it. However, the fundamental question is whether or not that restructuring is a reasonable plan or not. And actually, on that point, auditors cannot really challenge, because preparer knows better the industry. So if the CEO said this is reasonable, then it is quite difficult to make a counter argument. So then in combination with impairment only plus removing this one is quite dangerous. So I do not really support removing it, provided that we are not going to reintroduce amortization.
I'm very much of the same view as Martin. In other words, supporting the fact that we change our value in use calculation, but not including the threshold or not including the disclosure. And but probably not at this stage of the discussion paper, but we, at the time, if and when an exposure draft is being prepared, I think we should think carefully as to how to strengthen the guidance around the reasonable assumptions and the like. I'm always skeptical also when I see that there would be so much, I mean, there would still be differences between how the basis for a fair value measurement and a value in use in that case. I support also the fact that, as you put it in your analysis, that except for the market participant perspective, basically you have you're looking at the same entity. So not a distinct rule for the value in use calculation.
Tom?
Yeah, I support 1A, and I definitely think if there's a problem, which sort of that paragraph 26 that TAC pointed out, I've heard that there's a problem with people perceiving that there are optimistic assessments. And there's optimistic, if that's the case, there's optimistic assessments without the restructuring. And I don't think we should hold out the restructuring to offset the optimistic assessments. I think if that's the problem, we should address optimistic assessments. And so I'd be inclined to put the restructuring in. But I would try and do something, because I've heard at least from some auditors and stuff that the current wording does not give them enough grounds to stand up to what they perceive to be unreasonably optimistic assessments. And I don't know whether we should put that into this discussion paper, but I keep hearing it as a problem. And to me, that's the bigger problem than restructuring in or out. If we need to corral optimism in those things, because that is a problem. I mean, if there's already existing headroom and then there's an optimism cushion as well, that's even more to burn through.
Amaru.
This will be very quick. So I confirm my previous tentative decision. What I've decided before, I continue supporting myself. and I don't agree with 1B. I think I felt like, you know, I agreed with that, but I'm a little bit ashamed, so I'll try to put some discipline that is very, very high level requirement. So I like Sue's suggestions for us. If we are trying to establish some discipline, reasonable and supportable, that we use the other standards, and so this is mixed with judgment, might work, but I don't agree with 1B.
Gary?
I agree with Amaro. I support 1A, and perhaps for different reasons that have been articulated before. First of all, a future restructuring, to some extent, is an ill-defined term. You kind of know it when you see it, but it's not a crisp term, you know, that we've got. And then it says, or for a future enhancement. Well, what's that mean? I mean, every ounce of energy should be trying to enhance operations and so on. So what if I call it a voluntary early retirement program? Is that a restructuring? But it's something to take costs out. So I think we start, you know, picking on one or two specific types of ill-defined costs, when in fact everything you're doing should be trying to improve the operation. You know, what if you buy a company and they sort of had a run rate of a type of expense? You say, you're not going to spend it on them anymore. You're going to spend it on this to make operations more efficient. I just think it's unpoliceable and really unworkable. I think if we go there, I think the more likely than not, for the reasons expressed by others, I don't support either. Just defend the decision in 1A and live with it and see where it goes. I think over-optimistic cash flows, I think that's perhaps more internal controls, auditing, but also keep in mind the conceptual framework and other standards. You're supposed to be neutral and unbiased in how you approach your accounts and so on. So there is, it's not like there's no guidance out there on the subject. There is.
Darrell.
I support the answer on 1A. On 1B, to be honest, I was comfortable with more likely than not, and I'm probably comfortable with reasonable and supportable. I think they both established, to Tom's point, some kind of backstop that people can use in looking at the numbers. I support the quantitative disclosure, the qualitative disclosure. I do it for a simple reason. I think a lot of the time, most of the time what you're doing with these projections is projecting business as usual. In this specific circumstance, and this is a narrow circumstance, this is a circumstance in which I have decided to take further action. I've built the benefits of that further action into the specific cash flow analyses I'm doing. That further action has not yet met the hurdle of IAS 37, but I'm banking it already. And it seems to me that would not result, disclosing information about that would not be boilerplate. I'd have to be pretty specific about what I was thinking in that circumstance, and it would allow people on the outside to see whether or not the slightly airy thing that I'm talking about has some validity in just understanding where they are. So I'd probably be quite comfortable with where you were or the reasonable and supportable change as well.
I just went back, sorry, paragraph 25 of the paper quotes from existing IAS 36, paragraph 33. And paragraph 33 has the today's requirement is reasonable and supportable assumptions. That's the language that's in there. Then B and C in this paragraph then go on to say, despite having said that that's the requirement, B and C go on to say, use internal forecasts. And if we're concerned about excessive optimism, maybe we have to look again at the structure of B and C, that having said it to begin with, you have to use reasonable and supportable. It then just goes on to say, almost absolutely, thou shalt base cash flow projections on the most recent financial budgets forecast approved by management. Now, there is some tempering to that in subsequent paragraphs that says, well, you should check the actual versus past projections, but it doesn't tell you anything about how you weighed it. And I think what I'm hearing from today is that everybody is saying the requirement should be base cash flow projections on reasonable, supportable assumptions. Those are that's language that's there. And that maybe we have to look at how the discussion, we're going to have to open up this, if we move forward on this, we'd have to open up the drafting of paragraph 33 anyway, because that's where the prohibition on restructurings is. And maybe we just have to soften the you shall use it, because while use of internal projections is expected to be A, a cost savings, and maybe B, some degree of discipline, it's not just those preparing the financial statements doing it. I think some of the over-optimistic maybe, as long as you put it in a projection and approve it, you know, the standard says you should use it. So that's a complimentary suggestion, but the reasonable and supportable, Darrell, is the lead-off requirement for all cash flow assumptions in an IAS 36 test, not just for this.
And we know the yields are reasonable and supportable. Okay.
I was just going to say, just on point of Mary, so in the paper, in paragraphs 41 and 42, we do actually talk about, actually, we could explore actually providing a little bit more guidance around what do we mean by the various terms that are in IAS 36, like reasonable and supportable and internal forecasts, etc., etc. The reason why we haven't put that in the recommendation is, as people have highlighted, that that's about the whole cash flows effectively, and that's a wider thing than the scope of this specific issue and this specific objective that we were looking at, which was the future restructurings and the future cash flows.
It's also way bigger than the standard. Yeah, so it's words we use all over the place. Yeah. So,
yeah. And I wasn't saying maybe think about providing more guidance, application guidance, interpretation of those words. Just look at the structure of that section and see whether it gives undue weight to internal forecasts.
Okay.
Maybe we should we split the questions and do 1A, 1B, I, and 1B, 2?
Mm-hmm. Who can support 1A? One B.
One B
one.
One
B one.
One B one. Okay. Who wants A more likely than not threshold?
After.
Thank you.
Okay. That's a resounding success. Yeah. And then 1B2.
Just in the case of 1B, I suppose that 1A, we introduce that. Then we decide to introduce that threshold?
No. That's what we voted.
That's why we voted split.
We vote on
only one supported introduce 1B1.
Can we vote on that hand? Something more along the lines of...
But it's already there, I hear.
But making sure it's clear that it applies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So more reasonable and supportable than
What is it? What's 1B1?
Like trying to work on something like reasonable, supportable, building on that sort of idea rather than more likely than not.
And what does that mean to a forecast?
It's already there.
In there as the requirement. I mean, I think you're just saying point out that applies.
Well, it's your idea. It's fixing up those paragraphs, getting those paragraphs to work better.
It's a quite new idea.
I mean, that's what we should be done at an explicit draft stage.
Yeah, you guys fiddle around with that.
Well, I'm not sure, Francoise, only because I wouldn't be that keen if we go out and people think that because we voted on 1A, it means that whatever they put in their budgets, they can just stick to a model.
Is that what you have in your standard today?
No, but that might be what they think that we're saying. I just wanted to make it clear that the sort of if that's the normal idea, that normal idea applies here as well.
If the normal idea is reasonable and supportable, that's paragraph 33A, that any future restructurings are subject to that general reasonable and supportable. Seems a pretty straightforward observation.
Can we add that to 1A then? So we voted for those people that wanted to support 1A. It has an addition to it that the reasonable and supportable in paragraph 33 will apply.
And that's sort of what, in terms of the paper, in paragraph 25, that's sort of what we're saying there, that actually if you did nothing other than remove that restriction, that those cash flows would be required to be based on reasonable and supportable assumptions that represent management's best estimates of the range of economic conditions, etc., etc., and on the most recent financial budgets forecasts approved by management. So that's sort of where you end up.
Yeah.
And in the discussion paper, if we're not supporting any of 1B, and we'll come back to that in a second, that's what we would be presenting, that actually we're supporting a preliminary view to propose removing that restriction, and that therefore means... And we did give some consideration to a threshold or not, but actually where we've landed is that they would be based on reasonable and supportable assumptions.
Yes?
I think I support what Ed said, but I want to make sure, because to me this reasonable, supportable assumptions input applies generally across all cash flows. And I wouldn't want to end up highlighting more particularly the restructuring or the enhancement. So it's really reminding everybody that this applies generally too. And then I'm fine.
Bless you.
Okay, and then we have to vote on 1B2. Who supports that?
Six.
In a reasonable fashion?
Six.
Yeah?
Okay.
That was not supported sufficiently, or?
Correct.
No. Okay, we go on.
Yes, so regarding 18F, Valuing Use, post-tax paper, so in an earlier board meeting, the board tentatively decided to remove the requirement to
to use pre-tax inputs and a pre-tax discount rate to calculate value in use. And to disclose the pre-tax discount rate used, and paragraph 13 to 18 set out the basis for this decision. This paper also discusses the double counting of the tax cash flow and whether the board removes these requirements or not. The double counting issue still remains. This is discussed in paragraph 19 to 22. The staff believe that specifying how to avoid the double counting issue would require an extensive analysis of the interaction between IS 36 and IS 12. On balance, the staff recommends that the discussion paper should contain a brief discussion on whether there is a need for guidance on how to avoid a double counting issue. Questions for the board are included after paragraph 24. Do board members agree with the staff recommendations in paragraph 23 and 24 to include a preliminary view in the discussion paper to propose removing the requirement to use pre-tax inputs and a pre-tax discount rate to calculate value in use as long as internally consistent assumptions about cash flows and discount rate are used, and to include in the discussion paper a brief discussion on whether there is a need for guidance on how to avoid a double counting issue. So I would like to hand over to the board.
Yes, Martin.
Manik, I agree, but I should not have this discussion of double counting, because my understanding was that we have a not 400-page discussion paper. Therefore, I think we should not. Because also we cannot solve it. Why should we discuss it?
So you do not agree.
I agree with this.
Agree, but not with 24.
Not with this discussion of double counting effect. So not with 24, but with 23.
I agree with Martin.
Yes, I agree with Martin. Me too.
Yeah, so we agree with Martin?
Yes, we are basically agreeing with our decision.
11. 12.
Okay.
Personally responsible for this.
Final paper.
Yes, sorry, just reflecting on what that decision actually meant.
Plus later.
Right, sorry. So, agenda paper 18G, preliminary views. So the purpose of agenda paper 18G is to help the board assess the package of preliminary views it decides to include in the discussion paper, and how it aligns with the project objectives that the board set in July of last year. These objectives are listed in paragraph 3 of the paper. Although the paper analyses the preliminary views that have been recommended by the staff in each of the agenda pages 18A to 18F, which are reproduced in paragraphs 6 to 19 and summarised in paragraph 20 of the paper, the staff have tried to provide sufficient information to assess the board's indicative package of preliminary views if different to the staff's recommendations. And we'll see whether that works in a moment. Paragraphs 21 to 24 explain the basis of that analysis, which focuses on providing better information, reducing the cost and complexity of the accounting for goodwill and the impairment test, but also considering the implications of the preliminary views on the effectiveness of the impairment test. Table 1 and paragraphs 28 to 29 provide the analysis of the staff's recommendation, and the questions for the board are included after paragraph 35. So the board's indicative preliminary views differ from, and this is where I'm going to lean on help from my learned colleagues on the right as well. So the board's indicative preliminary views differ from the staff's recommendation by, so on disclosures, the preliminary view that the indicative decisions that the board have made doesn't in,
include removal of the pro forma information, but otherwise is in line with the staff's recommendation. The board's decided to, in the preliminary review, to include the presentation idea of the subtotal of total equity before goodwill. And in the value in use ideas, so the board's supported that in the preliminary views, but for the cash flows has agreed not to have a threshold, so not to support the more likely than not threshold. And that's about it. I think that's... Have I got that right, team?
Not to have the qualitative disclosures on the cash flows, and not to have the disclosures, or sorry, not to have the double counting issue.
The double counting discussion in the discussion paper. So in comparison to the analysis in Table 1 and paragraphs 28 to 29, I guess it means in terms of the package of preliminary views, so removal of the disclosure of the pro forma information, so that might add, compared to the staff's recommendations in 28 to 29, paragraphs 28 and 29 and table 1, that might add a bit more cost, but it will also provide more information, which users have told us it is very useful. The presentation idea increases the prominence of goodwill, as we've talked about, and it's a further response to the too late issue, and there's a minimal cost there. I guess not agreeing to the threshold of more likely than not on the restructuring cash flows, that actually may increase some of the cost savings, because it means that there are no circumstances in theory that actually the preparers would have to try to amend their cash flow forecast to take out some restructuring and enhancement cash flows. So that's sort of the changes I would say to the assessments that's in paragraphs 28 to 29. So I'd like to open it up to discussion now if board members have particular comments or clarification questions before we ask the questions.
So I'm not confused. I think what you are doing is basically summarizing what we decided, right?
Yep.
So why do we have to vote again?
Just to make sure we like the package.
The package
make
is
sure
enough.
Make sure we like the package.
Yeah. Yeah. The package is enough.
Cumulatively.
Look at the sausage.
So if I don't like the package at this stage, what would happen? No, it's a very interesting question, because, you know, I think it's a very good paper as a summary for us to have an idea what we've decided, but I felt a little bit strange for us to vote, because if someone doesn't like some aspect of the package, what are we going to do?
It's not an unreasonable question, because we've put it together in one.
People voted differently. For example, Gary was in favor of amortization, but was also in favor of the cost reduction.
Lamar, that suggests you shouldn't say no.
I'll say yes, because the fact is, if we aim to have papers similar as this one in the future, I think it should be, if this is the objective, if we like the package or not, I think the staff should go out of the meeting after all decisions taken, and then reconsider everything and bring to the board what the implication of the disparate decisions taken individually along 10 months, 1 year. After the discussion, it's quite hard for one to really assess the whole package.
Well, I've been thinking about all these elements in combination with each other for a long time, and that's why I'm very uncomfortable about where we landed. And I think every board member must have made.
That's what I mean. So if the objective is just a summary of the decision, it's very good for us as a reference. But to have this as an objective to assess the happiness with the whole package. I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying that if this is an objective in the future, I think the right way to do is go back, reassess the package, and say, well, there's things here that are not conversing in a sense.
I think I would agree with you. If we'd voted on a really weird set of things relative to what had been anticipated and relative to the staff recommendations, then maybe staff might have wanted to go away and digest what on earth it meant and what it achieved. But I think they've sort of guessed where we might land pretty well based on the staff recommendations and the alternative packages, which means I think it's okay to do it this way. But I think you're right. If it was something unexpected, might need to reflect.
Yeah.
Well, I had my card up. I'm happy with the package.
Yeah.
Martin?
And for me, the overall package depends on what we discussed on amortization and effectiveness of the test, how it is worded. If you really make this kind of very clear and give then kind of the readers, okay, please decide what you want and be aware, okay, that the effectiveness is not wording, I think that it can work. But as I said, it depends on that wording, because otherwise for me the story is based on our preliminary decisions, I think is, for me, it would be not a good story, because we are saying, okay, the effectiveness isn't a problem, we don't have a solution, we give them relief on the test and some disclosure, and that for me is not a good package based on the answer of the post-implementation review. That is my concern, but I think we can overcome that regarding when we have the discussion amortization, yes and no, as we discussed in our meeting.
How overcome this?
How we have discussed what you have said, okay, make it very clear, okay, if you are in favor of not going back to amortization, that is okay, that you are still aware of what does it mean, right?
Yeah. So, I am not comfortable with this package. I think it's not sufficiently balanced, but I accept the amortization decision. So I think they're basically everything hangs around that, and basically there will be two views on two packages. I think all the other stuff I think can fit in, but for me to reduce the impairment, diminish the impairment test in frequency, combined with no reintroduction of amortization, I find that very difficult to sell. Tom?
Just a quick question on paragraph 5. The last sentence says, this issue is intended to be included in the discussion paper. This just pops up here. Have we voted on this, or are we going to vote on in the future, or what?
So this, I think, is about the intangible assets being subsumed within goodwill. So it's something that we've voted on in the past, but it was just making the point that this is still going to be mentioned in the discussion paper as something that was explored but then wasn't pursued.
And so is it possible that you'd actually put it out there as inviting advice? Did we get it wrong? Or would it just be, we looked at it and don't bug us with it?
I mean, we would have to work out exactly what the questions are going to be, but I think that the intention was to get feedback from stakeholders on that very on that very basis. Actually, is this something that we should be looking at?
Doug?
Yeah, let me understand clearly what we are voting now and what we have voted. Because in your paper, you said the vote we made in the first five papers were just for indicative vote. So just if you single out amortization, if you single out some removal of annual test, so we made a preference. That's simply indication. But the very important decision is, as a package of the proposal, the answer to the PIR as a preliminary view, are we happy with the package of the proposal? That is the question we answer here. So therefore, the voting now is could override some indicative vote. That is what I understand. And then if I look at the package, I think it's very poor package. Because we are not going to address any too late issue nearly at all. We rather accelerate too late issue by providing, you know, relief of removing annual impairment test, providing relief of future cash flow, and then and also we provide some disclosure. It's fine. However, it's still not quite enforceable. So then I don't think our package is very responsible for the expectation all over the world. And also, we have to be careful that this is converged standard. And FASB, FASB is doing their own consulting documents in the future, in the near future. And then in the future, we have to discuss each other. And if we say, if we have such a poor a combination of proposal, what if FASB made a clear indication that reintroduction of amortization, we need to persuade not to do that. Please follow our poor poor combination of proposal. And we don't have any message at all. It's a pity to me. And therefore, I think it's a good opportunity for us to vote for the other package. And then I think, because it's the last chance, I think it will give us a lot of flexibility and also good opportunity for communication. And Tom said communication is very important. If we put out such kind of poor message, nobody would look at our discussion paper. Even if we had lots of good argument in the 400 pages of paper, nobody would look at it. But if we put out that we our preliminary view is reintroduction, then that will attract of lots of attention, and that gives us much richer discussion, even though the final outcome is same as the what we are proposing. So therefore, I think we have to seriously reconsider: are we happy with this combination of package? So I think we should. I support.
Well, we're not going to re-vote on amortization.
Yeah, we are not going to re-vote on this, but we have to vote for the package of the proposal.
Also, just to point out, it's not the first time the staff have taken this approach, and I think it is a good idea. When we didn't end well last time, but when we did it for IFRS 8, we voted on the individual items and then the package to make sure we were satisfied that overall it was worth doing. And I think similarly, it's a good idea to say, given our objectives and the fact this is a big deal and it's an important document and it takes time to do the exposure and everything, do we think this is a good package to put out? So I think it's the right question to ask. I think we have to be a bit careful. We can joke a bit in the room today, but I think we do have to be a bit careful not to have board members running around saying it's not a good document, because we want people to take it seriously. And I think the important thing, no matter what the preliminary view is that I think we've worked really hard to try and have balanced messaging to respect the fact that there are different views and why there's different views, and to really try to encourage people to engage in the process. I support the package. I think it's for the reasons I gave along the way. I think it's a good package. I know that some would like us to reintroduce amortisation. As I said earlier, I'm not sure I have the evidence to get me there yet, but I think we do need to do things to improve the quality of information for investors, and we needed to do some stuff also to address the cost points raised by preparers, and I think we've done some things there as well. So I think the package overall stacks up for me.
Anne?
I'm thinking about how we're going to present this. So based on the decisions today, we have a package. So we say this is the proposed package. And then we also say the package could be added to or changed by changing the amortization part.
so that we sort of are presenting two things to try and get the feedback on the package. If people have an element in the package they don't like, they will tell us about that. But we're actually saying, here's the package and we think this is an improvement and here's what we propose. And then separately we say, well, here it is, and of course we concede that another way of doing it would be to bring back amortisation. So that would be the package with the bring back amortisation. Because I'm just thinking about the way of presenting that will give us feedback in a manageable way.
Yeah, good point. Daryl?
Just to say, I think I support where we land. I think this is the sum of the conclusions that we've made. I think the package now is the package. I think as much as I voted for amortization, I think the reality is this is where we are. I think it is important, and others have raised the point, that we're going to be going out there and saying, to the point that we hear the six or eight core decisions, this is the leaning of the board. But we are asking people for views on each of those. And if, to Tuck's point, if they're not going to respond because we are... because they didn't get what they wanted, well, then that's not the right approach. That's not how feedback works, and if that's how they're going to respond, then we'll deal with that as it comes along. But I think people need to take a responsible view, look at what they're seeing. I do think this is the best view of the board, whether or not I was on the winning side of all of the votes.
Mary?
Building on Daryl's comments, I think, and Anne's thought about how do we sell this, Sue said, we can joke about it here after a long day of discussing it, but I think this is the package. You know, with IFRS 8, we said if this is the package, is it worth going ahead, and we concluded it was not. It wasn't that what was left was bad, but we decided it was not. In this case, I think it is worth going ahead, especially because in this case, with a discussion paper, there are two things that are happening. One is we're including the alternative views, and they aren't alternative views because we don't have those in a discussion paper. They are the other argument that's not the preliminary view of the board. I think we don't have to we should avoid casting it as here's the winner, here's the loser. Would you prefer we went for the loser? Because this isn't a vote, you know, just a straight vote thing. I think we have to succinctly say this is the preliminary view we have. This is the other preliminary view we considered. Here are the reasons people gave for supporting the one they did and not the one they didn't. And I think we also have to recap for some of the people the exploration that we made of why we ended up here. So, because they can keep saying, do more, but we've tried for 5 years now, and this is the best we can do. And if we're not going to do this, I think there's, you know, nothing else we can do. And the other thing is we have to show some leadership on this in terms of saying this is it, not, well, we've worked on it for a while. Why don't you give me your opinions on what you think? I think we're saying this is what we think we should do. We'd like your comment now, but this is what we think we should do, and we aren't just putting it out in a neutral kind of way, because if so, we'll work on it for another 10 years. Hmm. And then maybe we'll have the evidence for Sue.
I'm not very comfortable with this package of views presentation because I don't think our discussion reflects that we've been very cohesive and we have varied from issue to issue. I would want to say a few comments about what I heard. First of all, I don't think a post-implementation review necessarily leads to changes. So I really question this notion of we have a poor package. We have a limited number of proposals eventually. But I wouldn't call it poor. I would, personally, I think I would make a difference between the disclosure sets on the one hand, which, first of all, I wouldn't want to be called poor, because if these disclosures can be effective, I think they're going to achieve a lot. And we are they're really well supported around the table. And then to the other problems, I think I mean different views are expressed, and presenting it as a package, I think. I would prefer presenting, in fact, the results of the research and the pros and cons of various solutions, And eventually, if you think that helps identifying a preliminary view on each issue, but I don't think we gain anything from the package. In the discussion paper, I don't think that we're going to gain anything from a package. I don't know how this is going to help the discussion. In fact,
you would rather present it as all separate issues, which is going to happen anyway, I would suppose.
The only thing that I would eventually highlight with more emphasis would be the disclosures. And for the rest, I would have the discussion on each and every possibility.
Well, that's what people will end up doing anyway. But these are the issues that the board could get a majority on. So if you got the package or not, that's what it is. And I think it's important that the outside world sees that and makes up its mind. I'm a bit ambivalent about this because on the one hand, I would like to express somehow that I think this is indeed an insufficient package when you look at all things together, and that's what I've been trying to do all through this process. I don't think it's a sufficient outcome given the problems of cost and effectiveness. On the other hand, I want this to go out and have people, force people to get an opinion around this and give us feedback. So I would hate this to go to a vote and then we have a minority. Because, for example, Gary, he voted in favor of the impairment exercise, but probably you find the package as a whole insufficient.
That's probably accurate.
Yeah.
But I think, Hans, it depends on what question you're asking.
Yeah.
Does the board agree this package reflects the votes is different than do you agree with the votes? Those are different questions. Yeah.
So I think, let's just leave it at that. These are all the issues that the board could find a majority for. You make up your mind.
Hans, can I just ask you, if the first vote, whichever vote it was, the vote about adding, reintroducing amortization, if that vote had gone the other way, and it was a close vote, if that had gone the other way, and then it was with all the other things we've decided today,
then I would have been perfectly comfortable. Yeah.
Then you'd think it was a good package.
Well, I would be comfortable with it.
Okay, thank you.
But I think, sorry, Hans, if you allow me, sorry.
Sure.
Sorry. I think you touched the right point. That's what I tried to brought at inception. This is only a summary of what we've decided for a discussion paper. It's not really a question of are you happy for us to publish or not. We discuss it. This represents the majority of the votes. This is going to a discussion paper. Let's publish and let's seek feedback on this. And that's
what you want, Françoise, I think.
That's the point.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right, so we don't vote. The staff. Oh, and I especially want to. First of all, I wanted to thank the staff for this leading us through this really difficult discussion. And papers were of such quality that we at least knew what we had to decide. And I think we came to some pretty clear decisions. It's Wong Hee's last time that he's at this table. His assignment to our organization has now definitely been amortized.
And it's not impaired.
So we thank you for you're going back to the KSB, yes. I understand, in Seoul. So hope to see you there when I come to Seoul in September. We thank you for your hard work. I've heard you really made a lot of progress in the years that you were here. So I hope it was worthwhile for you as well. It certainly was for us. Thank you.
All right.